evening. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's tape number 417A, side one, November the 30th, 1979. And we've tucked almost the last month, and that's the last month of the year away. Can't believe it's gone so fast, but this is the last week of November. Somebody asked me about the music that I've been playing on the tapes the last few weeks. This is from an album called Supertramp, Breakfast in America. Group of young people, it's from a song called Child of Vision. I gave you a rest in the past week about the Iranian crisis. I realized that we would be standing at a stalemate, and it was a good time to take a break because the events may escalate in the weeks to come. But we'll get back to it now and do part two on the Iranian crisis. Before I do, or opening into it, I want to mention two developments on the John Kennedy assassination. One took place in Fort Worth, Texas this last week. Michael Eddowes, the British author, had offered a $100,000 indemnification bond involving legal risks of exhuming Lee Harvey Oswald's body in Tarrant County in Fort Worth, Texas. He claims that's not Lee Harvey Oswald in the grave, and I support his contention, not that it's a KGB spy, but that Oswald will not be there. In fact, there will not be a body in that grave when they dig it up, and that hearing takes place in April of 1980. I don't believe the courts in Tarrant County will allow that body to be exhumed, but they have already turned down an offer. He gave $15,000 deposit on an insurance bond for the exhuming of Lee Harvey Oswald, and that was turned down. I'm sure the other legal maneuvers will also be turned down. This last week, we read about Suzanne Osgood, a knife-wielding woman from a mental hospital, always programmed from these strange mental hospitals, who went into the offices of Ted Kennedy with a knife and let out a blood-curdling scream and was stopped by the Secret Service. I don't know whether or not she was like Sarah Jane Moore and Squeaky Fromm with the assassination attempt of Gerald Ford, whether it was a real attempt or not. This is now the third female almost assassin, or they're using women. This is a 38-year-old woman, an older woman like Sarah Jane Moore. A fellow researcher called me and thought it was a coincidence because of Lee Harvey Oswald, to use an Osgood. I associated the name with Sandra Good. That's the roommate of Squeaky Fromm, a woman in jail now for trying to kill Gerald Ford. They're both members of the Manson family. Sandra Good and Suzanne Osgood sounded alike. Of course, in recounting the story that goes over the wire services, the media reminds you, after they write up about Suzanne Osgood, that John Kennedy was killed, the brother of Senator Ted Kennedy, by Lee Harvey Oswald, and Robert Kennedy was shot by Sirhan Sirhan. So that every time there are these attempts, whether they're real or not, or altercations, or somebody set in and then stopped, allowed to go so far and then stopped, the news then constantly rewards us with a reminder that Lee Harvey Oswald and Sirhan Sirhan were the assassins, while they actually have no physical evidence to link them to the murder through weapons or autopsies. But it's been 16 years, and that line still holds. I have to make an apology. I did a tape just this last week on the anniversary of John Kennedy's assassination. I think it was the first time in all the years since he was assassinated. I've been on the air, it's 8 years, this is my eighth year, and doing these tapes, that I actually forgot to do one tape in memory of that particular assassination. I was so caught up in the news of the week and so much material that I've learned since the death of John Kennedy, and the realization that Kennedy is just one of so many, that the actual date didn't register on my mind until November 22nd, and I didn't even put it on the tape because it was just a part of the milieu of what we're living through now, and just let it pass up. But I did want to mention this Suzanne Osgood, and thinking of Sandra Good and Lee Harvey Oswald and Oswaldo, and the use of the similarity of these names. Maybe it's coincidental, and maybe it isn't. John Chamberlain had an article in Congressional Quarterly that was reproduced in the Washington Post, Senator Kennedy Will Confuse, and it puts down the policies of Senator Kennedy and how he would be, in quotes, weak or broken apart. And the article goes on to say that Mr. Brzezinski is managing to push Jimmy Carter into taking a tougher line with the communists, and Kennedy would appear too dovish by comparison, and we can't have dovishness with the Soviets. because there's a drive for the third world to get together and overpower the United States, that we need a strong position. Carter would be strong. Brzezinski is pushing Carter to the brink. Kennedy would be the center. He'd be too weak. And, of course, we have two choices. If the military's gone to all of this trouble to get in the position they are now to get ready for World War III, what if Kennedy blew it? John Kennedy blew it for the Pentagon by pulling out of Cuba and not killing Fidel Castro and taking over Cuba, and they were afraid he would withdraw from the troops that he put in Southeast Asia as advisors of Green Berets and not have that war after he was elected in 1964. So either we are ready for a full-scale war that will keep Brzezinski and Carter and Kissinger and David Rockefeller in power, as I mentioned several weeks ago on the tape, or they have to kill Ted Kennedy and thus assure that Jimmy Carter would be reelected. Those are the only two choices I see now, a full-scale war or kill Senator Kennedy or both. I can't believe that the Pentagon would go this far in doing all the dastardly things that they have done over the past years since World War I and then World War II, and then give it up because a few people wake up and go to the voting machines and say, I want a change. If you press the wrong button and they're out of power, they would give up too easily. They're not going to give up that easy, so that their only choices are to have several assassination attempts and then have Ted killed or get us into that grand war right now. If you have the past tapes going way back, this is 2 years ago, just exactly November the 20th, not the 30th, almost 2 years ago to the week, tape number 296, Lydia Blades did a tape with me. It was the beginning of the meeting of Begin and Sadat, and the title of the tape listed in your list here, if you have it, is Peace? In Middle East, The Politics of Sacrificing Libya, Iraq, and Syria. And this goes into the reasoning behind the United States and Sadat, or the Borman Brotherhood, combining with Begin, was to use the Sinai as a launching base against Iraq, Syria, and Libya, that are leftist third world countries. Now, just this week, that's 2 years later, Mr. Begin is talking about using the Sinai area that we just gave to Egypt as a launching pad for a war in Iran, or to take these other countries. And Moshe Dayan was on television just yesterday morning talking on Good Morning America about the takeover of this Sinai area that he had said should belong to the United Nations or the United States, but which was turned to Egypt. And Moshe Dayan was agreeing that this piece of land could be used as a launching pad for war in the Middle East. I just can't believe that people such as Moshe Dayan from Israel, surrounded by enemies, wants the United States Army over there. And I always thought that Israel was being propped up by the United States as a military base, not as a country, not as a decent thing to do, but as a launching pad in case we needed all the Arab oil in the Middle East. So now they're talking about 11 countries that are off bounds that you shouldn't go to, that aren't safe, and three of those 11 are Libya, Iraq, and Syria, the three that we thought could be wiped out if we set up a confrontation and launched our army over there, just as we did in Southeast Asia, to take over the various countries there, assure our organized crime of the narcotics traffic of the Golden Triangle area. We would have the poppy traffic of the Middle East, so the organized crime and the Pentagon work hand in glove. And now we have our fleet warming up just in that section, as we predicted or thought it would be doing 2 years ago. In case you want to get more knowledgeable about the area that we're invading, and it always is interesting to do that. I don't think enough of us read the history of Cambodia or Laos or Thailand or Vietnam, the history of it, before we sent people over there to die and to kill and maim and poison. We didn't study the terrain. There are two books on Iran. One is called The Imperial Shah, an informal biography, and I'll give you this title on the printed sheet. It's put out by Little Brown and Company, and you can read about the Shah of Iran. There's even a better book out that came out in 1977 called The Crowned Cannibals, and it's about the Shah and his family, put out by Vintage Press in 1977. This book goes into a notorious Nazi general, Zahedi, and it tells about his links to Adolf Hitler in Iran and how his son was the ambassador from Iran to Washington, D.C. Now, over in Iran, Mr. Zahidi, the father, was supplying dope, narcotics, and blackmail and prostitution and assassination teams to the Shah and to the Iranian government once the Shah was put in by our CIA, by Allen Dulles, John Foster Dulles, Richard Nixon, it names those various people, Mr. Schwarzkopf, General Schwarzkopf, who trained the SAVAK. He also was involved with the Lindbergh kidnapping and with Chappaquiddick, this particular Schwarzkopf. But this book talks about the Americans in 1953. Well, later Zahidi's son came over to be the ambassador of the United States, and he was supplying our congressmen with women and dope. And I mentioned on the other tape the blackmail that Khomeini has because they got this list from Zahidi. But the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And if you read The Crowned Cannibals, you'll get a little background on the lovely family of the Shah of Iran and the Pahlavi Foundation and how it was set up and how the United States was involved in all our dirty tricks. And only by reading this can you understand how they feel about us over in Iran, that this isn't just a momentary indigestion they're having, but a genuine feeling based upon genuine facts. Good title, The Crowned Cannibals. Now, the Iranian crisis, of course, is developing into something very broad. And whenever a situation develops, whether it's the assassination of an individual or a Jonestown affair, I've learned to break down the subjects or the categories of the events as they take place almost immediately from the time the signal comes that this is going to be a big story or something to follow. I break these subjects into dividers or manila envelopes and then label them, and then articles that come out pertinent to those subjects, I file them into those sections as much as I can till my mind is set of the way the events are taking place. And I've given you a list here of 17 categories that I have for the Iranian crisis that I'm putting articles in or cross-filing. And I'm not going to cover all of those today with you. I'm just going to go over the classifications to show you how I'm following the events. And then today on the tape, I'm only going to talk about number one out of these 17 areas, because that is the most fascinating in my mind. Number one is the dilemma, the way we can't move. We're absolutely at a stalemate. The combine of Nelson Rockefeller, the Chase Manhattan, Mr. Brzezinski, that Polish Nazi, and Henry Kissinger, the German Nazi, and Prince Bernhard from the Netherlands, member of the Gestapo. These people have cooked up a script to weaken the United States. The United States is going to be destroyed from within, and we've spread ourselves thin all over the world and build up these weapon systems while we're decaying inside. And the United States is falling apart, and the goal that was set for the Thousand-Year Reich is working, and as we diversify our strength and look more ridiculous. And the point at which we fall apart fast or decay, it doesn't matter. It's happening all the time, and it's been going backwards, I think, since 1963 when John Kennedy was killed and the electoral process, for all purposes, was over. The least likely confrontation, the one that maybe they didn't anticipate to the full extent, that has broken open this conflict to something different than they figured, was the Ayatollah. The two unlikely adversaries, the USA versus the Ayatollah. I think the script was that if the Shah had to be out, they'd put an old man who was weak and unarmed and a religious fanatic, halfway silly, temporarily on the throne, and let him set the country back to the Middle Ages with the women's costumes and their religious beliefs and their flagellations, and then when we arrived, they would welcome us with open arms. What happened was that the intense hatred for the United States is spreading around the world, and the latent hatred, it's similar to adolescence, when young adults begin to verbalize and get their legs and get their spending money and wheels, and then can tell their parents how much they've hated them for 15, 16, 17 years. I mean, they hated the pablum, the toilet train, the discipline, the going to bed, the selection of friends, the making them study boring subjects, the personalities, the alcoholism, the cruelties. All of that comes out in young adulthood because it's the first time that they really have the muscles, not only to run, but to kick and to give it back, and they give it back. And these countries are going right now into their real adolescence and youth and maturity, their awakening period. Their teacher has been the cassette machine, the FM radio, the newspaper, the alternative press, the music, the message in the music, which is so important. And while the Ayatollah has forbidden music, the music is one of the means by which the people have caught on and even learned to be sympathetic to what he was doing. He hasn't really understood the radical Western music and how it's changed people's minds all over the world. We didn't anticipate him as the man that we would have to confront, and now we're caught ahead of a world war that we had really planned, we weren't really ready for until 1985. We're caught with this wonderful figure, this Ayatollah Khomeini. So the dilemma, I call it the dilemma, and I'm going to talk about maybe as many articles as we can, the David and Goliath, the unlikely adversaries. Now, another section I have, which I say may do these things at other times, is articles on the Shah, the controversy, should he stand trial, what are the legal rights, giving up the $60 billion, the financial, will it break the banks of the United States and Chase Manhattan? Can we afford to say no, you can't have your money? The tying up of the money of the Shah himself personally. The Shah's illness, the excuse for the illness, the subterfuge, bringing him to this country until we're on the verge of war. When all the fleets are there, then he skips out. The Iranian money that's tied up in the United States, this is a controversy of the banks of Saudi Arabia, other countries with the United States, their insecurities in our financial bankruptcy, where we are right now in our economy. Then the oil cut off from the USA. We cut off the Iranian oil. They've cut off from us. What does this mean in terms of other countries cutting down their oil, squeezing us, raising prices? Oil as a weapon has now escalated for full scale. Then there's the Ramsey-Clark, Dr. Yahtzee-Brzezinski connections. Ramsey-Clark, I've never trusted him. He's a snake in the grass, and he was instigating and provoking the Ayatollah Khomeini, get your money back from the Shah. He is to the Ayatollah what Mark Lane was to Jim Jones in whipping up a frathy, and because Congressman Ryan was coming down there and everybody had to be killed so that we wouldn't know the extent of the mind control and the program that was going on in Guyana. Ramsey Clark is a provocateur disguised as a leftist, even not really disguised at all, whipping up the Ayatollah to a point that he went for it, but then he ended up with the spontaneous support of his people, and he had the good sense not to see Ramsey Clark when he realized what was happening. The Ayatollah is pretty smart. He wouldn't see a representative of the Pope. He wouldn't see Ramsey Clark. He wouldn't even see the PLO representatives, Arafat or any of them, because he knows how dangerous they all can be, and he's standing alone, literally alone, with the people, and the people all over the world must be watching him. Then the David Rockefeller, Kissinger, John J. McCloy, the Chase Manhattan, Middle East oil connection. So that is a category of itself on how they've manipulated us, you know, from the end of World War One and then World War Two, and now these dogs are in a bind. The world attention is focused upon them for the first time like it's never been before. And even though Jimmy Carter comes out and takes the blame for Henry Kissinger, he is their man, and we'll go a little more into that dilemma. But this team handpicked the President of the United States so that an outside country is saying, do something. The world is saying, do something. But Jimmy Carter is Henry Kissinger, John J. McCloy, David Rockefeller. They picked him. They picked Jimmy Carter as their president. So we're not really talking to a man, even if it was Richard Nixon, who was in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, a vice president and a president. He represented a cross-section of the American people. If he's rotten, we're rotten. If Gerald Ford was in the House of Representatives, whether he's on the Warren Commission or short while a vice president or president, he was a part of the milieu of the fabric of America. If he's corrupt, we're corrupt. But he was a part of the whole of America. Now, that's a little different thing. Even Lyndon Johnson served his years in the House of Representatives and went every year and stood up to re-election, even if some of the opponents might have died along the way. The corruption is America. Corruption is American politics. But there's still a fine line of difference between Jimmy Carter, who was an Annapolis admiral, graduated from the Navy School, similar to Haig, who went to West Point, handpicked by Kissinger and Brzezinski, the two proteges, is a difference because you can't appeal to the President of the United States. When he gets up there and speaks, you're not listening to the President. You're listening to Chase Manhattan. You're listening to David Rockefeller. If that bank goes bankrupt, if the oil interests are jeopardized, he is David Rockefeller. He is Brzezinski. He was selected when he was in Europe. He was groomed for 2 years by Brzezinski. He doesn't have a foreign policy. As governor of Georgia, he had no foreign policy. Jimmy Carter is the Pentagon. He's the Navy intelligence. He is Brzezinski, Kissinger, and David Rockefeller. He isn't the President of the United States. So when he gets up, he's like Pinocchio in the hands of the puppeteer. When you hear him speak, he's cool and calm. He is them, and he can't separate himself from their interests, and he would put us in a war if it's what they want. If they want a war, we'll have a war. And that is what Jimmy Carter is, and you can't confuse his position. The Khomeini can't appeal to him as a person when he's a puppet. Jimmy Carter's team put the Shah of Iran into office. They made the Savak. They trained the Savak. So you can't expect him to send the Shah back or to send the money back or to be objective about the whole game. Number nine is Ayatollah Khomeini. His leadership as a person, his background, his charges that the embassy was a spy center. What he objects to is the documents that millions of dollars were being sent in by Chase and Rockefeller and Brzezinski and those people to overthrow his government just before they took the embassy. They have this proof, and they want to try these people as spies. That they are not. They're just as delegates or persons being entertained in a country, guests of that country, in the United States Embassy. He says they were there to overthrow the existing government. Now, we have done this in embassies in 77 countries, but never have we been put to the test for that. That's what's so interesting about this whole thing, is that we're being put to the test, that our embassies are to overthrow governments. The people of Chile have not risen up yet. They don't have a leader yet. That tells them that we killed Allende so that Pinochet could take over, so that Goodrich Rubber and Dow Chemical and Chase Manhattan and ITT can rip and rape the country. That's what our embassy was there, to overthrow Allende and put in a person good for the multinational business. The next section 10 is on the hostages themselves, their physical condition, their releasing, articles about them being brainwashed, and CIA articles about the hostages. The next is about provocateurs. Whenever we want to prove a certain point in this country, we set up incidences such as the alleged kidnapping of the governor in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Later, those charges were dropped. There was a bomb that was supposed to be on a plane put by Iranians. All of a sudden, that's hushed up. There was an airplane that was hijacked in Texas, and the man said, "Take me to Iran." All of this is to get talk on stations like KGO radio on the West Coast or on the East Coast or all around the country, foment anti-Iranian feeling. They're kidnapping our public officials. They're bombing our airplanes. They're hijacking us to Timbuktu. All of this is whipped up, and yet there is no evidence that these people really were part of an Iranian establishment that is pro-Khomeini. It's more agent provocateurs, the kind that Richard Helms could set up in the Central Intelligence Agency before he became the ambassador to Iran. The next section I have, a big section, of course, are the war threats, the threats of Jimmy Carter to go to war, the articles on the war, the maneuvers of the fleet, the media begging for war, the war plans, and the bays and where they are, where the ships are. The next section is on solutions. What are they going to try? The choices of articles on the United Nations, on Representative George Hansen. Of course, the establishment is furious with Hansen. Here's a staunch conservative who is very much part of our establishment in the Congress of the United States, who flew over on his own and came back and said, "Put David Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger in there for the hostages." That's outrageous. That made Jimmy Carter jump up the walls to think of that. And, of course, he would get congressmen to object. But Hansen got a view of what was going on, and I commend him for his courage. He crossed the party line from being what was a blind conservative, just holding the party line, let's go to war and get him, to jumping the ocean at his own expense to see what was going on. That's what we need, our people to see for themselves what's going on and to talk to the hostages themselves. Then we had that Pakistan embassy where two Americans were killed. Very low-key, no mention of that. We're not going to war with Pakistan. The president of Pakistan is still our friend. We need Pakistan, and it's very interesting how low-key. Nobody's been killed in Iran, and we say if one person is killed, we go to World War III, but two people were killed in Pakistan, and that's nothing at all. Then articles on the Iranians in the USA, the deportation, the demonstrations, the job losses, beating up in the Santa Rosa prison, the housing and the attacks. Then an important section is the Arab response from other nations and the taking of the Grand Mosque in Mecca. Now, I'll be adding to the Iranian conflict, but within that category, the most important articles I have fit into that section. And, of course, it is the dilemma that interests me that is so fascinating to see America with its back against the wall. Now, why would I be so glad to see that, an American citizen, you know, happy that America is against the wall? Well, personally, I'm ashamed of America. Many of you know I was planning to leave this country in 1970. That was just almost 10 years ago, and 2 weeks before the end of the year, December the 14th, my daughter, Bonnie, was killed in an automobile crash, and my other daughter, Barbara, was almost killed. We had applied for citizenship in Canada, and we're about to leave the country. And because of that, we were forced to rearrange our family and the circumstances, and Barbara had to have surgery the next year and had lots of injuries on her body, and the chances of going to Canada then were put off, and we stayed in the United States. And then Watergate broke, and I wrote my story, Why Was Martha Mitchell Kidnapped? And then I began radio work and began to expose the evils of the system of this government at home. If I was going to stay here, I would work here and do that instead of running away and leading another kind of life in Canada. Because if my alternative is that I have to stay here, I wasn't going to stay here and keep my mouth shut. I've seen the United States do so many terrible things all over the world since World War II in so many countries that I was ashamed of this country, and I also felt that my children would not be safe in this country, because someday the world is going to rise up against the United States and put all the crimes that we did in front of us for a full view, and we were going to have to count for ourselves, just as they're asking the Shah of Iran to account for himself. If he took money out of those countries, we've drained every country. We've set up torture, assassination teams, and so forth, and I really felt in 1970 that we would be leaving early in 71, and the accident took place in December of 1970. And after a year of recuperating and being just with the family and getting over that tragedy, I got back to my work, and as I say, I have stayed with it ever since, because I think we are going to pay our dues, and the sooner we exposed our own crimes and admitted them and went forward, the better we would be psychologically and the healthier we'd be as a country. It didn't work that way for most people. They didn't think that way, and now the country is bankrupt, and we can read many articles about the United States emotionally and psychologically bankrupt because we did not concert our effort to expose what was happening around the world that we as Americans were doing to other people in terms of lives and pain and depletion of their money and grabbing the profits for the handful of a few American businesses here. It didn't get distributed among the people, but even if it did, it wouldn't have been right. The ripping off and raping of countries all over the world and putting in these treacherous dictatorships. As I say, I was embarrassed by it. I hated it. I hate it now. And the only way I can face myself in this world today, as I've done in the past, is to do what I'm doing to try to set the record straight so we can go forward. They don't have to read a list of the crimes we've done. I see a litany of it every single day in every newspaper. On the other side of this tape, I'm going to share some of the articles that have been coming out on what I call the dilemma of the United States versus the Ayatollah Khomeini.